Hey everybody, it's Dave Weiner. Hey everybody, it's Dave Weiner here, and welcome to the 10th episode of Rebooting the News. Jay, are you here?
I'm here. Hi, Dave.
Awesome. That is so cool. Hey, I've got my radio announcer voice on today because we are really on a radio show. You know, I did radio when I was in college, just FYI.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I was a college newspaper editor.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Well, why am I not surprised with that?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, and I started an underground newspaper in high school.
Very cool. See, we've been involved in the press since the beginning.
I have, absolutely. And that was back when I used to talk about computer geeks with derision. I used to talk about them in very derisive terms. So.
My brother was a computer geek back in the days of the punch cards. He was one of the first original geeks before people knew about geeks.
Well, I have to confess that I have actually spent a fair amount of my life programming on punch cards myself.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I learned when I was in college, because I'm very old.
Yeah. I have a way to get us going here tonight, if you don't mind.
No, I don't mind. Of course I don't mind.
Well, one of the features of a rebooted news system, in my view, would actually be borrowed from the tech world. And it's the notion of bug catching,
mm-hmm.
which is a very useful thing that programmers regard as normal. If you help us catch a bug, if you point it out, that's good because it helps us make the program better. And there's no way to catch all the bugs, right, before you release a piece of software. And so
no,
you depend on users to help you out.
Well,
and for some reason, which we could talk about, that attitude has never been part of professional journalism, even though there are such things as corrections and they do occasionally appear.
Right.
It's actually more of a problem when you point out a bug in journalism than a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I regard this as a defect in the culture of the profession. And it's something that we really saw on display over the past week or so in the case of Maureen Dowd and the apparent plagiarism or at least unauthorized copying from Josh Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was, after all, a blogger who pointed this out, somebody at TPM Cafe, which is the user portion of Josh Marshall's site. And as far as I know, nobody at the New York Times has even thanked the person for catching the bug.
No.
You know?
Absolutely not.
And
quite the opposite. If you read Hoyt's piece today, he needs an editor to go over his copy and to make it more neutral because there were a lot of pejoratives in there. You know, it was definitely not neutral. It was heavily colored.
Talking about the Ombudsman's column, the public editor.
Yeah. I mean, in fact, all of the journalists' opinion pieces about the Dowd thing that came out over the week, they were all far... why aren't they trying to be perfectly neutral? Why don't they edit their copies so that take out all... And it's one thing to write the first draft and let your colors show, but that should never make it out to the public. I mean, I think he said that she was beaten up by people on the internet, and that's got a lot of connotation to it because, especially because she's a woman.
Well, it's exactly the opposite of what I was saying, and that if we point out there's a problem in what you wrote, a pretty serious problem that violates your rules as well as our sense of, you know.
Now, I have never, in all my years of pointing out problems with what reporters are doing, whenever I've ever gotten acknowledgement of it, it's always been in the form of an attack against me personally. I have never had it received in the way it was intended. And, you know, I've never had it happen. I had a run-in with the Guardian newspaper in the UK, a clear case of conflict of interest. Somebody wrote an article twice, wrote an article about areas that I was involved in, and he was a competitor, and he wrote a news article. I said, this is not allowed. You can't do this. They came after me. One time they threatened to sue me because they just were throwing their weight around. When I said, fine, go ahead and sue me, they backed down. I mean, it was like, because they had absolutely no leg to stand on. I mean, all I had done was just say what I thought was true, you know. No, the industry does not deal with feedback well. And to say that the tech industry is good at it, I think you're overstating the case.
Well, I didn't say that, but I do think that the idea of...
some companies, some people in the tech industry are very good at it.
Catching bugs is a normal thing and is something that you have to help us with.
Yes.
In a rebooted system of news, that would be how it works. And that's why I liked what Scott Rosenberg said today in his post on the Maureen Dowd incident, where he made the point that it's pretty simple, guys, what should happen here.
Mm-hmm.
When there's a question raised about your reporting, instead of saying, we stand by our story, or that didn't happen, or obviously this wasn't plagiarism, or something like that, instead you say, thanks, we're checking it out.
Right.
And you do check it out, and wait as long as you need to, take as much time as you need to establish what happened, and then come back with one report and say, okay, we checked it out, and this is what happened. And really, no other system will do. And it's going to be a shift for professional journalists, but that's what they need to do.
It's amazing to me that this is actually necessary, because this is the exact behavior they enforce on the people that they cover. You know, I mean, they have counsel for politicians when they start doing the damage control. I mean,
they say,
of it.
Right.
Maybe you should not do that. Don't stonewall us. Just you know, take it all out at once. You know, and the Nancy Pelosi thing. I mean, that to me. Well, all this is going on, a trivial, stupid little thing with Dowd, right? And where we really do have some big issues with these guys, because they raised the issue. They raised the issue with Pelosi, and I think that they were right to do that. You know, it's funny because we lost an episode here. I don't remember when we talked about this. I think this was in the lost episode. That, you know, Pelosi was being accused of what? Of knowing that there was waterboarding going on, right?
Well, of being informed about it and doing nothing about it back.
Right. Well, so is the press completely complicit in that. They knew, too. I know that they knew because I knew. And how would I have found out if it had not been through the press? I mean, everybody knew that was going on. To single out one person... Okay, it's fair to actually single her out, but then it has to land on the desk of everybody else who was stood by and did nothing, because that's the way our government works. It's a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. That means we're all complicit in it. That means the Republicans need to stand up and take their share of this, and which is probably, well, it is definitely greater blame, as does the press. And here we can't even get an acknowledgement, and that's really... the basic first thing has to be acknowledged. Jay, there absolutely was an act of plagiarism in there. There's absolutely no doubt about that. The words, if anybody doubts it, compare the paragraphs. I mean, you could not possibly pull that out of thin air twice. That one paragraph couldn't happen.
No. Well, it's very
stylized.
And also the reaction of her editor, Andrew Rosenthal, who's the editor of the editorial pages. His statements, basic to me as a reader, were, first, I don't care about this,
right,
and this is no big deal. I mean, that's basically what he said. And
you know how I would paraphrase that? Let the meat cake.
Yeah.
In other words,
pretty much.
We're too important to actually answer this question. We're busy. We've got important things to do. We can't be bothered with this.
Mm-hmm. So a culture of bug catching would really help a rebooted system of news. We can agree on that part.
Absolutely. I mean, put that on the to-do list for sure. I would also ask
one other question, and maybe this is something we put on the table for a future discussion, is that now we can watch the conversation amongst the people of the New York Times on Twitter. And I've been watching them carefully for this last week to see any mention of the Dowd situation.
I estimate there probably was none.
There was absolutely none.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is then, will that ever actually happen? Do they discuss this amongst themselves in a private, do they have a back channel that we can't see? Or why would it be that a reporter would not want to discuss this?
I think it's tribal. I think it's a matter of loyalty. It's the old, we don't air our dirty laundry in public thing. But
yeah.
It's also related to the idea that was a product of the print era, where the notion is that you're presenting to the world an edited, checked, authoritative, and correct version of what went on over the last 24 hours.
And I was going to add plagiarized. I was going to add the word plagiarized.
Well, that would be cynical. But, I mean, as opposed to, Dave, this is the best we could do in figuring out what went on over the last 24 hours. And we know it's incomplete, but it's close to what happened, and you can help us improve it. That is not the implicit assumption in the minds of working journalists. And so when something happens that shows that there's a rupture or a tear in the facade, the smooth facade of professional control, it's a big problem. Whereas in the culture of blogging, where people are actually a little bit less pretentious about what they're doing or less persuaded of the authority of it.
How about less coordinated? You know,
yeah,
more,
and less coordinated, right. Then
more spontaneous.
It's
more
easier to say, oh, I got that wrong, and fix it. So I really think that it's related to ideas about how you present authority. And there's no doubt that the online world and journalism moving online really presents a challenge, because it forces journalists to kind of reconfigure their authority, because they're not able to present that same facade. And better at this.
Doesn't it say that there needs to be another function, another organ to the journalism, body of journalism, that the public editor, I think that's what Hoyt's actual title is.
Yes.
The public editor ought to be a member of the public, not somebody whose job is to bullshit the public, because that's what Hoyt does.
Well, I don't think that's what he does. I don't agree with you.
Well, I know. No. You and I live in two different worlds, Jay, okay? I live in the world where I say what I think, okay? I don't know what world you live in. But we don't have to agree on these things, right? But I absolutely feel every time I read something from Hoyt, I am being pushed out of the picture. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The job is to control me, to get me out of having any say or influence at all over this dialogue that takes place, which is the exact opposite of what his job is, as far as I can see. I always thought, my understanding was, his job was to represent me. And he absolutely in no way does even come close to representing me. When we read an article like this, is absolutely appalling. His purpose here is to dismiss me.
Mm.
And I don't mean me personally. I didn't take any of this personally. I'm saying me as a reader. And this is the same, this is the problem. You know, we get caught up in this all the time with reporters who point fingers at us and say, you want this wonderful system to crumble. And my response to that is absolutely not true. I want a reformation of the system. I want it to actually start working, because I think we desperately need it to work, and it doesn't work.
Well, so do I.
Good. Okay, we found something to agree on there. Because I don't mind saying it's bullshit if that's what I think it is. I think that was bullshit today. and I don't accept this, and I'm not giving up on this one.
Well, I don't think it was a strong column, but there have been other columns he's written that have been very strong.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, let's take that offline then and see if we can't come up with some examples of that. And I'd love to see it. Let's get
all
on
right.
to the next topic. I think we've definitely covered this one at this point. 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Something
I wanted to ask you, and it has to do with the culture of technology and geeks and programmers. And the basic question I want to ask you is, why are the geeks so bad on usability and the whole challenge of lowering barriers to entry? And
why do you say that they're bad at it?
Because I don't think that that technology is as easy to use as it should be.
Yeah.
And
well, that's for sure.
I know from the history of blogging that when blogging software first emerged from a sort of a geek or technical point of view, the techies weren't really that interested in it because it wasn't much of an advance. You know, of course, from my point of view, it was a huge advance. So I just wanted to ask you, like, where does the question of usability, ease of access, lowering barriers to entry, making it simple for people, is that a part of the technology industry, or is it kind of counter to the attitudes?
No. It's part of it, for sure. When there are successes in the technology industry, it's because of that. It's because there's been some success at making things usable. It's hard, Jay. That's why it's so rare.
It's
deceptively hard. And it requires something that, there are all kinds of programmers, and there's all kinds of programming and all kinds of skills required for it, and that itself is not well understood, that there are disciplines within programming. And as different as, all the different functions that make up the medical profession or the legal profession or the journalism profession, for
mm-hmm.
that matter. I mean, if you look at all the different kinds of journalists there are, there are music editors and food editors and people who go cover wars and
right.
there are copy editors. You get the picture, right? There are so many different – well, programming is relatively new and also very, very misunderstood in a lot of ways. I remember my first confrontation with – serious confrontation with ease of use. I thought I had been developing easy-to-use software, and I was known at the University of Wisconsin as being the guy with the great error messages. That's how they saw me. And, of course, what I was trying to do was make humanly accessible software. So there was a great deal more to it than just, good error messages. But I remember I was claiming that my software was easy to use, and so a friend of mine who was a lawyer said, okay, well, I want to use it. So I said, really? And he sat down at the computer, and he said, let me use it. And then I said, you don't need to do anything. I understand the software sucks. All I had to do was visualize a user sitting down,
mm-hmm.
actually sitting down and using it, and then all
right.
of a sudden I realized it wouldn't say a single thing to this guy. He would
mm-hmm.
sit there and go, what should I do with this? And
mm-hmm.
he didn't have any clue.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have, I don't know if I said this before, but you have to have a sense of empathy, a strong feeling of empathy to...
Right.
Meaning putting yourself
in the position of the user.
That's correct. And that is one of the hardest things to do. I don't care what profession you're in. It's a very rare thing that somebody can get out of their own body, get into somebody else's body, and look out at the world through their eyes and have some kind of sense of what they're actually seeing.
Right.
Because that's what it takes. In everywhere, that's why Francis Ford Coppola, I'm sure, can do that, right? Because how else could you make a masterpiece like The Godfather if you can't have a feeling of, well, what's it going to be like to sit in the audience?
Mm-hmm.
Marlon Brando, same thing. I'm sure he has a great understanding of what it feels like to be out there because he made art that was just incomparable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think
the reason I ask you, Dave, is I think that there's something very essential to journalism about the whole question of ease of use. Because if you think about it, what journalism is really about is making it easier for people to use their democracy. And
their
lowering...
What does that mean? Oh, people to use their own democracy,
yes.
Not the journalist democracy.
Lowering the barrier to entry in political discussion, you know, in public life, making it possible for people to participate without having a lot of prior knowledge.
That's really deep, Jay. That's really great. I've never thought about it that way.
I mean, why else do we need journalists? You know, and
well, I don't think
how
that
does
that's necessary.
Well, let me just finish the thought. When professional journalists tend to think about this, they tend to phrase it in a different way. They say, we should tell people what this means to them. People, the reader wants to know, what does this mean to me? And that, I think, often sends them astray because it puts journalists in the position of sort of being the pronouncers, the authorities on how this is going to affect your life. And if instead of saying, how does this impact me, they just try to lower the barriers to entry, make it easy for people to understand, make it easy for people to be part of their town, part of their election, you know, part of their political system. If they thought of what they were doing as ease of use for the system, I think they would be on the right track.
Now you are on the right track for sure, because that is actually how you make software easy to use. So you're talking about blogging software. I can tell you where and when I was working on that. It was about exactly 10 years ago. In the end of May 1999, I wrote a piece called Edit This Page. And I'll post it.
I know the piece.
Yeah. And
I've reviewed this history.
Pardon me?
I reviewed this history.
Did you? Okay. Well, I just want to sort of summarize the ideas.
Yeah.
But what the process that led to that was writing down on paper the steps that I had to go through to make a change to a page on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something like 18 steps to it or 20 steps. There was a lot of steps to it. And so what I posited was that if I could get the number of steps down, decrease the steps, that every time I did that it would get easier. And what you want to do is make it less, the shorter the distance between the conception of I want to make a change to the realization of that, the change has been made,
right?
The more fluid the whole process is going to be, the better the writing is going to be, because the whole problem was like, I see a mistake here, what's the price for fixing that, you know,
right.
It's too big. You know, and at that time, by the way, the idea of a user being able to change their own copy on the website was considered impossible. Nobody ever thought about that as a possibility.
That's what I'm saying.
Right, exactly. So it was, from an engineering standpoint, a question of making it easier, keep constantly refining it until it couldn't get any easier. And that meant changing the model. Okay? At some point, you had to actually change the data model. The conceptual model for the reader and for the editor, so that they became a single entity, that was the only way to achieve any more economy or any more ease of use. Which says to me that it's more than just the journalist's responsibility, because the journalist doesn't have the ability to change the model. The journalist has the ability to point a mirror at us and show us what we're doing. That's what the journalist gets to do. That's keeping it really, really simple. You know, if you try to give the journalist too big a job, the journalist gets two things. First of all,
oh, absolutely. They can't solve problems. It's not their job to make the system better. They're dead.
Right.
They can't
and
have
they
the job of the political
well,
leadership and so forth.
Right. And they fail.
Mm-hmm.
They first of all get arrogant, and the second thing happens is that it fails. And those are two very poisonous things happening at the same time. And that's really the world we're living in now. Is people, some of whom are extremely competent people, okay, and also extremely well-intentioned people, but being given this enormous responsibility that is basically not their responsibility, and it's also impossible. So it's more than just the journalist, which is the good news, because there are so many people that want to be part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
And the journalists are acting kind of against their own interest, I think, but trying to keep these people out of the process. And you're seeing that extremely visibly in things like the Dowd situation with, you know, the Foyt, you know, putting up this big barrier saying, you can't come in here, this isn't any of your business, we're going to take care of this, you know. That's why I'm looking for cracks in this. I'm looking to find out whether or not the people, that's why I had a question I brought to this. I'm sorry, I'm talking too much again. I want to turn something over to you. This question came up in another context. Are people who are using Twitter, are they bloggers? Should we think of those people as bloggers? Should we have the same expectations and hopes for them that we do for bloggers?
Well, you made the point a while ago that Twitter lowers the barrier even more and allows even more people to participate in blogging. But I think of it as an extension of blogging and a refinement or elaboration of blogging. And so in that sense, they're bloggers, although the form that they're using, the Twitter system, has very important differences from the blogging system.
Well, you've been Twittering now for a year, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Any observations?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I put my observations in a post that I put together at Tumblr, my new Tumblr account. And part of what I was trying to do in that post is sketch the whole system that I use now that I'm on Twitter and still a blogger. So the way it's working for me, and I don't pretend to be representative, I'm not trying to be representative. What I'm trying to do on Twitter is show that there are different uses for it and show that it can be used with very clear intention in a different way than lifecasting, which is the most natural or original use of Twitter. So for me, these things work together. A daily Twitter feed, which is links and comments and pointers to new and interesting stuff, has in it, for me, certain themes that persist over time. And those themes can, within the space of a few weeks or a month, lead to a blog post that isn't simply coming out of my head, but is actually coming out of the interactions on Twitter. So it allows me to write blog posts that I already know are kind of in the center of an ongoing conversation because I've used Twitter to test them. And then my hope is that if the blog post is successful, it'll etch itself into Google, into search, and become a sort of a permanent part of the web. So you have these different parts of the web working together, and Twitter I see as an extension of blogging to the live web, the daily web. And so in that sense, I think of the people on Twitter as bloggers. But I also think that Twitter has so many limitations, and there's no reason to deny them or evade them. They're a very important part of the system. And, of course, everyone talks about the limitation of the 140 characters, which is true, but it also creates the system. So I have ways of getting around that, and one of the reasons I started a Tumblr blog was simply to have more space for things that I wanted to quote or comment on that I could then refer to from my Twitter feed. So when you think about the relationship between blogging and Twitter, Twitter is a very effective notification system for what you're doing with your blog, and the two work together. And so I think of it as a refinement and an extension and elaboration of blogging, if that answers your question.
Did you understand that difference, that distinction, when you started using Twitter, or is that
no.
something you learned?
No.
You know? What did you think of Twitter when you first started? What was your
As often happens with me, I had a sense that it was important without knowing why.
Uh-huh.
I had a sense that it was something new and different that I should check out. And unlike most people, when something has got a lot of buzz around it, I assume that there's a reason why. I mean, I know about hype, too, and I know that there's a lot of inflation in trend watching. But I figured there was a reason why. And I didn't know what it was at first, but I wanted to know. And enough people that I knew, like yourself and Jeff Jarvis and others who are early adopters, were on it. And so I didn't know what it was, but I wanted to know, and I got enough feedback early on that kind of pushed me in. And it's a very familiar feeling for me to not know why I'm doing something, but to understand that it's important.
I guess, would you think you would be surprised? Do you think that you a year ago would be surprised that you're using it this way today?
I would be surprised in the sense of not being able to predict it,
You wouldn't say, no, that would never happen.
No.
How about Second Life? Did you try Second Life?
Yeah, I did. I didn't. It didn't make a lot of sense to me. And it didn't.
So you didn't get as far with
it? I didn't get it. No. I didn't see it. I saw it as a lot more artificial than Twitter. And if I hadn't felt that my skills and talents and attitudes were compatible with Twitter, I wouldn't have stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you another question. Remember a few episodes back we were talking about your experience with the suggested user list. Do you have any sense that was the right decision, wrong decision?
Oh, it was definitely the right decision. Sure. Yeah.
It was the right decision. Okay.
Yeah. I am not a mass media person.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a similar decision a while ago. I actually told the producers of Howard Kurtz's Reliable Sources, don't invite me on anymore.
Really?
I don't want to be on, yeah. I felt I sucked at it. I really sucked when I was on the air, because I had been on that show. And it wasn't working for me, and I wasn't doing anything particularly interesting for them. And I just said, this is just so completely disappointing. Don't ask me on anymore. and they cooperated.
They seem to agree, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm in the same club. I asked them to stop inviting me, and they listened to me even before they knew that I felt that way.
Oh.
I mean, they never asked me to be on it. That didn't come out right. I think Howard Kurtz is one of let's not go there. Okay.
No.
Leave the man alone. Leave him in peace. So I'm looking at some of the things that you were talking about, the Church of the Savvy.
Yeah.
What is the Church of the Savvy?
Well, another aspect of a rebooted system for news for me would be a replacement for what I consider the religion of the professional press to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, to me, objectivity. It's not that journalists are liberals the way the people on the right say. It's not that really they're power worshippers the way people on the left tend to say. But I think the real religion of political journalism, professional journalism at the elite level, is savviness. And savviness is a very kind of hard to grasp ideology, and it's invisible to a lot of the people who hold it. But the person who believes in being savvy is with it. They're ironic. They see through surfaces. They understand the motivations of the players. They're interested in kind of how the game works. They would think of themselves as masters of the strategy part of public life. And their most important thing is not to be fooled, not to be persuaded by images, surfaces, slogans. They're the great seers through. They demystify politics for us. And journalists would rather be savvy than right. They would rather be savvy than civil. They would rather be savvy than strictly liberal or than righteous. And I think of it as the undeclared ideology of the press. And when I refer to the church of the savvy, it's just a way of saying that this is their belief system. This is what they really care about.
Who are some of the high priests of the Church of the Savvy?
Dana Milbank of the Washington Post, Mike Allen of the Politico, David Gregory of Meet the Press, Mark Halperin of Time Magazine would be like the Pope of Savvy. John Harris, who's the editor of the Politico, who's a pal with Halperin, would be in that category. Howard Fineman, who you see on MSNBC all the time.
Yeah.
If you ask, well, what is the expertise that these people have? It certainly isn't in economics. It's not in policy, right? It's not in history. It's in the game. And they think of themselves as masters of the game.
Right.
And I think that this is a way of seeing. It's an ideology, but it's a very tricky ideology because it almost depends on seeing the people on the right who are railing at journalists and the people on the left who are criticizing them as unsavvy, and anyone who's sort of unaware of how politics really works behind the scenes is unsavvy. And the savvy press tries to clue us in to what it knows. And I think one of the reasons it's so insidious is that it forces journalists to identify with the savvy players who manipulate the rest of us. And that's why I'm so much of a critic of it.
So is their power going up or going down? Or just staying about the same?
Well, the power of the savvy press is completely bound up with the ability of the professional class, of the people in the political class, the insiders, if you will, to monopolize politics and control it. So insofar as that class is losing power, which it is gradually because of changes in the culture and technology, they are losing power. But they're still in place, you know?
Right. Well, they wrote off Hillary Clinton after Iowa, and she came back in New Hampshire. You could see them sort of scurrying and trying to put their world back together again because it sort of fell apart there, didn't it? Or
well, first they wrote off Obama for Clinton, then they wrote off Clinton,
right. Right.
And they actually made a series of mistakes throughout the campaign. What?
It doesn't seem to be working for them, does it? I mean,
it's not working for us.
No, it sure is not working for us.
It's not working for us, but it works for them in the sense that it's reusable from campaign to campaign. It's you can maintain it from administration to administration. It always allows for a kind of a handle on the political scene. It's easy to produce opinions on talk shows when you are part of the Church of the Savvy. You can ask, not is what Cheney said true,
right,
but will it work?
Or did he land a punch? Did he land a punch?
Yeah, will it work? And that's the essence of the attitude, right? Not is it true, but will it work?
Right, right, right.
And it's a lot harder to figure out if it's true, you know?
Oh, we know it's not true. I mean, there's no real debate there. It's like they don't deal, well, whatever. We're in a tough bind here because we're now at exactly 40 minutes. And
that's good.
Is it? But what about the inspiration? Come on, we can't end on this savvy stuff. We've got to have some inspiration, Jay, don't you think?
Well, here's my source of inspiration. It's different than what I anticipated, I would say. My source of inspiration for this week is Elvis Costello. And
wow.
His song, What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding.
It's a wonderful song, isn't it?
And what I find inspiring about that song relates to what I just said about the Church of the Savvy. Because if you think about what he's saying in there, what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding is that these are the important things in life. And
yeah.
His tone in that song is not dreamy. It has nothing to do with the hippies. It doesn't sound like, when you go to San Francisco, be sure to wear flowers in your hair, right? It's the opposite of that. It's angry. It's
right.
Got a propulsive beat. It's it's got edge. It's got irony. It's got passion. And he really wants to know what's so funny about peace, love, and understanding.
Yeah, that's the beautiful thing about Elvis Costello. He has all those things plus sincerity.
Plus sincerity. And
yeah.
If we're trying to move off the ideology of savvy, which I think is a losing game, then consulting that song would be a place to start. So he's a source
of have it playing right now. Can you hear it?
No, I can't hear it.
Really? That's too bad. Well, I'll tell you, we're doing this now on Blog Talk Radio, the real Blog Talk Radio. And in the future, if we want to, we'll be able to put songs on here. So if you, but I think you're going to have to think about it in advance. So we'll have to sort of cue it up, and there'll be a button, and you can hit it, and the song come on in such a way that everybody can hear it. But
I think that would involve us in copyright problems, wouldn't it?
It would. But you know, I think that, well, whatever. Let's
reboot
that
in the news legally.
I'm not a lawyer, man. That's I don't know. You know, that's a subject for another day because
fair use, right?
The internet seems to go astray of those copyright laws, and the world still seems to be going around. So you know, so Jay, I think we did it. I think we've put another one in the bag.
It's been wonderful talking to you.
Awesome. See you next week, man.
Bye for now.